Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, the same person who actually knows very little about foreign policy and geography, has called for a global NATO. I suppose we can file that under rules-based order. The fact is, the geopolitical order is in collapse, the same order the West created. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He is a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the new book, Russophobia, Propaganda in International Politics. And we cross to George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In fact, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start out with Glenn in Oslo. Glenn, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that we have the UK Foreign Secretary talking about a global NATO. We've talked about it on this program. But, you know, Liz Truss's presentation, if we can put it that way, really was a vision that should terrify all of us, because a global NATO, as we have said on this program, is essentially short-circuiting international law, i.e., cementing Western hegemony over the global system. Most of the world isn't on board for that, but I guess nobody told Liz. Go ahead.
I agree. And I think this is doubling down on what was done wrong after the Cold War. Because, again, when the Cold War came to an end, initially we had agreements about creating this common Europe with common security with Russia instead of against Russia. But with Russian weakness, I think we embraced this concept of hegemonic peace. And this is, again, this is built into all of U.S. National security strategies, that they, if it's overwhelmingly dominant, no countries can aspire to challenge it, then this will be the foundation of peace. But obviously, this depends on marginalizing rising powers, be it, you know, Russia, China, Iran. So this kind of creates perpetual conflict. And now that you have an actual, not future multipolar, but the multipolarity is here, you know, the U.S. can go two ways. Does it want to create a new international order based on recognizing this different poles of power and having security where we minimize the security dilemma in which, you know, we have agreements how the U.S. doesn't threaten Russia or China and they minimize their threats against the U.S. But that's not the way we're going. According to Tuss, she's suggesting let's double down and go all in, which means let's go global NATO, in which she envisions the democracies of the world countering the authoritarians. But this is largely, in my opinion at least, a bit of a propaganda pitch, because the world is not divided along, you know, this new Cold War ideology between democracy and authoritarianism. You know, Russia's not fighting for authoritarianism of the world. This is, you know, this is in the mind of Tuss. So, and indeed, you see countries like India, the largest democracy in the world, they're not going against Russia. And also on the other side, you have a lot of authoritarian states linked with the United States. So I think this this global NATO is a way of trying to shape the narrative of this being this huge global conflict of good versus evil, free versus authoritarian. So again, this is how all major states form their language in conflict. So.
Yeah, NATO just has this really long habit of being that friendly, smiley face alliance, George. But George, one of the interesting things from Liz's presentation is that Russia is the enemy. China is the enemy. I mean, the mask is off right now, okay? No longer talking about projection of stability and all of this. No, I mean, there is no such thing as the indivisibility of security. And she said it, okay? So at least we know where we stand. Go ahead, George.
Well, definitely we know where we stand. The curious thing is that she titled her talk, The Return of Geopolitics. There was no geopolitics in anything that she said. I mean, geopolitics is supposed to be about the influence of geography on the international relationships of state. There was nothing about geography there. That wasn't really even very much about economics. It was a purely ideological statement of intent. Not only did she talk about a global NATO, she said that the G7 has to be an economic NATO. So in other words, we're going to use this body of the G7, which was supposed to be helping countries out during recessions and other economic calamities. No, we're going to use this body to wage a war against Russia and, to a lesser extent, China. I mean, she got onto China a little bit later on. And she also talked about not giving countries access to the global economy, as if somehow the global economy is the private property of the G7 powers. It was a declaration of war. I mean, there's no question, but what she was stating there was a declaration of war on the part of the leading Western powers, and said, you know, if you don't follow our path, we are just going to destroy you. We're going to destroy you economically. We're going to destroy you militarily, because there's, you know, obviously a lot of implication of military stuff. It's a vision that cannot but lead to war. I mean, you know, there's just no way that, you know, you can. She didn't even have the usual proviso that other dignitaries have. Even Stoltenberg would say, well, we must still maintain the dialogue with Russia on issues that matter to us. She didn't even say that. She just doesn't want any dialogue. I mean, it's just all-out war.
Well, at least, Glenn, at least during the Cold War, everyone kind of warmed up to the idea of peaceful coexistence, okay? I mean, that actually is what got us through the Cold War, accepting that you're going to be out there. The other side is there, okay? And we will engage when necessary, though there's still an ideological, military, political enemy. Liz doesn't even go that far. What I find remarkable unremarkable, is that in her speech, there are references to international law, but only that reinforce Western hegemony. And little UK is being the arbiter of all things. I mean, you know, that speech sounded like it could have been from, like, what, 1872, maybe 1912, but it doesn't fit into 2022. That's my reading. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, of course, and I think this is why NATO has found it very difficult to recruit, again, this global campaign, that outside of NATO, there's very few countries who are taking active sides and even putting sanctions. This is pretty much a conflict between NATO and Russia. And this is, again, one of the problems of what we had over the past 30 years, given that we've never removed the dividing lines. We're just competing where the new dividing lines on the continent should be. So this is why the rest of the world effectively looking, it's going, really, it's Britain after, you know, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, are they really the champions of international law? So I think in the West, we don't have the moral authority, which we often assume that we have. When it comes to Liz, I think you're correct on what you refer to, because you know, it's widely recognized in the British media that she's trying to channel through her inner Margaret Thatcher. She wants to be, you know, this is what she's going for, Iron Lady. But you know, the actual Iron Lady, she was she was putting on this tough exterior, but she also recognized what you said, the need to actually find some middle ground and accommodate your adversaries. Otherwise, if you refuse outright any compromise or accommodation of the opponent's security interest, then full war and full decisive victory over the enemy is the only possible outcome. And this is, this will be a disaster. So I think she maybe fell in love with the myth of Thatcher instead of the reality. And it's very dangerous. I'm not sure how serious they're taking her, because I know that she's making a bit of a pitch for the domestic audience. Also, there's a lot of pressure on Britain post-Brexit to find its new role in the world. And without this political role within the EU, it's, trying to have this military role that, you know, they're very open. This is a source of influence in Europe. It's leading the front. It's leading the fight against Russia. It's a military campaign. Of course, they have real concerns about Russia as well, obviously, but this is also a large extent about finding Britain's role in the world.
You know, Georgia, I mean, obviously she's making a pitch for her inner Thatcher. She's wants essentially backstabbing Boris Johnson, which is very unpopular right now, and finding a role for the UK after Brexit. And this is a perfect way of worming your way into European institutions. But I would posit to both of you, the more that neoliberalism fails, the more it aggressive it becomes rhetorically. And that's what I found the speech to be so remarkable, is that its reach, its intensity, as everything is falling apart around them, okay? I mean, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia does hurt Russia, but the blowback is even worse on Europe, as we all predicted. George, go ahead.
Yes, there's no question. And Britain is indeed suffering economic consequences. Food prices shooting up, gas prices shooting up. And the government is unpopular. It has fallen substantially in the polls. It's likely to suffer big calamities in the upcoming local elections. So this policy isn't in any way something that's popular within the country. So, she's obviously making a political calculation that, Boris Johnson is for the birds and she will be in place to pick up the pieces. It seems hard to believe that the Britons really want this, what she's offering. Because what she's really offering is that, we're now out of the EU, but we found a mechanism whereby we're actually going to dominate the EU because the EU is now going to be entirely subordinate to NATO. And we, as the loyal poodle of the United States, will get to call the shots. So she was very mocking about the Germans, the German fantasies about how they're going to change Russia through trade. That's all out of the window. So she's very much now, we are going to be the leaders of Europe thanks to NATO. It can't happen. Britain just simply doesn't have the economic and military strength to do so. And she's evidently forgotten all of the military fiascos, just sheer military incompetence of Britain's recent campaigns. I mean, whether it was in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, so they just doesn't have any of the resources for this global role she envisages.
Well, George, since we have we go from winter to winter, the upcoming winter in the UK, there are a range of estimates, but quite a few people are fuel insecure. I suppose fighting for democracy in Ukraine will make up for the cold when they're sitting in their homes with no heat. I wonder, George, people are ideologically motivated these days. Go ahead.
That's the thing. As she talked about, we're going to do this for Ukraine and do that for Ukraine. And Ukraine's fight is our fight. She never really explained how is Ukraine's fight the fight of the British. I mean, Ukraine's nowhere near Britain. Ukraine has never been in any way a kind of a national interest of Britain. No military alliance exists with them. So she just makes this assertion, Ukraine's fight is our fight. Therefore, we must pour in, indefinite resources to it. It's just baffling. I mean, like everything else about that speech was just baffling.
Well, it's certainly a wedge to maintain relevance of NATO, which we've discussed quite often on this program. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. All right, let's go back to Glenn in Oslo. Talking about the continued NATO expansion, which essentially is the origins of the conflict that we see in Ukraine right now, I can't get away from the meme, who's winning and who's losing? Because depending on your media, menu, what you're consuming, you're going to get radically different opinions on who's winning and who's losing in Ukraine. And one thing is for sure, gentlemen, at least a lot of promises of a massive military lethal aid to Ukraine is in the works here. One has to wonder, considering timelines, Russia's almost out of ammunition, though General Milley, that thoroughly modern guy, says it could go on for years. I mean, even within their own discourse, I have no idea what they're talking about. Glenn, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, there is definitely a narrative problem because the way I read the conflict so far has been, initially Russia pushed hard into towards the capital, and this was trying to get a quick victory and also convincing Zelensky to find some agreements on Donbass. However, when that didn't pan through, it was a good way of tying up a huge amount of forces in their existing position around the capital. And this allowed for Russia to place its troop or shape the battlefield in Donbas. It also put the logistics in place by connecting Donbas with Crimea and effectively encircling much of the bulk of Ukrainian troops, which had been mobilized and built up towards the front line of Donbas prior to the war. So I think when the Russians pulled out of away from Kyiv, the narrative in the West was, look, the Russians are running, we're winning. The NATO and the Ukrainians are winning.
Pronoun is important there, yes, go ahead.
And yeah, so every title is on the headlines is, you know, Putin has lost, and finally this is the end of the regime and end of Russia. And, you know, the hubris, I think, went to the heads of everyone. Now we're kind of waking up to the reality that actually over the past 2 months, Russia's been pummeling away at the front lines of Donbas, weakening the front. They've been cutting off a lot of supply routes. So now you have a severely weakened Ukrainian defense, low on ammunition, low of fuel, and poor supply. And over the past 2 weeks, we see Russia begin to punch through a lot of these front lines. And now suddenly the narrative has to change because we're seeing out of the, especially Britain and the US, some reports coming out that actually the Ukrainian front in Donbas might be crumbling. And if this is where most of the Ukrainian troops are, and if this falls, Russia can freeze up tens of thousands or over 100,000 troops, which can just march anywhere it wants to Kharkov, to Odessa. And this is creating some panic, but it's also creating some need to change the narrative. Because on one hand, Russia's losing. On the other hand, it's full panic because now we have to send in an ungodly amount of weapons to turn the tide. So it's the narrative is very confusing, especially if you open any British or German newspaper now.
Go ahead, jump in on that, George, because you get the feeling Russians didn't take Kyiv. Was that part of the battle plan? Does anyone in the West know what the plan was? They all assume they do, but. You know, that's why I've always found it befuddling is that, well, maybe that was just a blocking effort to do what they wanted to do in the East. And now what's being, we see the crumbling Ukrainian military in the East. And Kyiv has no strategic value whatsoever because it's not part of the plan to control all of Ukraine. If it is, it hasn't been revealed. Go ahead.
No, that's exactly right. And that's... has been the staple of the Western media commentary since February the 24th. Oh, Putin has failed because Putin has failed to take Kyiv. But there's no plan anywhere to suggest that was ever the goal of what Russia's aims. Well, and I don't think it ever was because it doesn't make a lot of sense to go into these big cities where tanks can't really maneuver very well and you're victim of snipers. I mean, they're essentially just meat grinders. I mean, this is where a military just can get destroyed trying to take cities. I think it was always about, as Putin articulated it on February the 24th, it was about liberating the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics and what he called the demilitarization and denazification. And that, I think, is going ahead. I mean, I think, obviously, the destruction of the Azov forces in Mariupol, I mean, that's been done. I think the demilitarization will be effected. I think the Russians will eventually destroy the bulk of the Ukrainian army in the east. And I think that will be that. I think Russia will then have accomplished its goals. I mean, I think that they may well go for Odessa, but again, that hasn't really been specified that will be the case. But if, I think the way the Russians are calculating it, if the West continues to pour in this weaponry into Ukraine, then I think they'll just go further. They'll just simply take, the Ukraine's Black Sea coastline. And that way, they'll basically control the Azov Sea coastline, the Black Sea coastline, and then that's it. Like I say, leave the rest of Ukraine to NATO. Okay, you want this rump state? Take it.
Glenn, that's really what I've surmised from the very beginning. No one wants to say it publicly, a little bit on the fringes, but essentially, what we're going to have is a partition. Russia has no interest in Western Ukraine whatsoever. By the way, the Poles do. We'll see how that plays out. That could be very interesting. But
a rump state is in the making. It's really interesting. After the month of 1 month of the conflict, Zelensky could have settled for what the Russians were proposing because he didn't have control over the Donbass and he didn't have control over Crimea. So he would have been giving away something he didn't even control. Now that has changed. That is a major shift in this because at the end of the day, it's not what Moscow is going to control. It's going to be what Kiev controls. And that it gets smaller with every passing day. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of the problems of continuing this war. I mean, because now that the Ukrainian forces are suffering defeat in Ukraine, in Donbass, all the escalatory efforts by the West in terms of helping Ukraine is making things a lot worse. Now, obviously, I can see the opposing argument that, you know, supplying weapons, helping them to defend themselves, that this is a moral and right thing to do. However, one has to be honest what is actually happening, because when Russia first went in, they were very open. They didn't want to even strike too many Ukrainian troops in their barracks. They didn't want to go out for the electricity. They didn't want to take the water, no civilian infrastructure. But once Kyiv did not want to negotiate and even walked away from the negotiations, you see Russia now, the main strategy is just they have to defeat these troops in Donbass since they won't be pulled out. And that's why, you know, the Russians have more artillery. The Ukrainians are fighting well, but again, it's all math at the end of the day. And the Russians have a lot more artillery and they're just pummeling them back. So these forces are being either destroyed or captured now. So it's a lot of destruction. And now that the West is pumping in this billions of dollars of new weapons, well, how would Russia respond to it? Well, we already see that they want to prevent this from entering the front line. So now there's a lot of attacks on the railway networks, the energy station, bridges, a lot of this infrastructure, which is also needed for an economy. But this is to prevent these troops from reaching the front lines, you know, creating bottlenecks of groups of soldiers, which can then be hit before they reach the front line. So there's, by every step to, you know, help Ukraine, the country's being plunged more and more into becoming a huge war zone. And again, some of this is very predictable. When the United States kind of outlines its ideas of creating, making Ukraine into a quagmire, into new Afghanistan to drain Russian sources, we also have to be honest what that means. It means making Ukraine into Afghanistan, and that means it will be devastated. And, you know, that doesn't mean, of course, blame can be put all around, but the whole point is to what extent is this escalation in the interest of Ukraine, and to what interest, or is it only for the United States, which is now saying very openly, our goal is to bleed the Russians dry. We want to have regime change. We want a decisive victory over them. So if this is the goal, are we helping Ukrainians? We, the NATO, or are we destroying, using them analogy? Well, as a stab, to stab the Russians, but then, sacrificing the Ukrainians on the way. I think this is a necessary discussion to have, but we don't have it in the West, because if we suggest that the West is not actually helping Ukraine now, but sacrificing it, you would be labeled a propagandist of the Kremlin and you would be canceled.
Well, yeah, George, the cynicism is so galling, it's hard to comprehend. I mean, first of all, the complete one-sidedness of the coverage of the conflict, only using Ukrainian sources, believing the Ukrainian government. But then, look at all of these sums of money and weapons. Well, if you get into the minutiae, George, it's basically a lot of junk that nobody wants, okay? Let's give them this. I mean, it's like 30 years old. Send it over, okay? Is it work? Nobody knows. But we sent, these quote-unquote German tanks that don't even work. They haven't been made for a long time, and there's hardly anyone around actually to train Ukrainian troops to use it. I mean, the cynicism is just, galling, and it's very difficult to comprehend, because it is the West is fighting a propaganda war. It's not really doing anything to help the Ukrainians militarily. Go ahead, George.
Oh, it's entirely a cynical policy. Neither the United States nor the UK nor most of NATO cares one bit about Ukraine. For them, Ukraine is a mechanism for mobilizing NATO, mobilizing the West to wage this, this geopolitical struggle that Liz Truss is talking about. So yeah, the longer this that goes on, the longer they imagine that this is just going to bleed Russia, the better they assume that this will be for NATO. And yeah, hence the talk, we're going to get the Western Balkans into NATO, we're going to get Georgia, Moldova, everybody into NATO. But the one thing they don't care about is the life of Ukrainians. And then you have to then wonder about what kind of a leadership Ukraine has that they don't see where this is going, that this is actually destroying their country, that, you know, within 5 years, there'll be very little of this country left. So it's cynical and tragic.
Yeah, and at the same time, I'm glad you brought up the current leadership in Ukraine, because whenever you have something like this, there's inevitably, George, it will be the stab in the back. Why didn't we succeed? NATO failed us. The West failed us. And then you get into what you and I have talked about in our podcast very often, a growing civil war. So even when we have hostilities come to an end, a civil war will continue. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and in Budapest. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, cross talk rules.